Hello and welcome to Your Call. Investigative journalist Catherine Jacobson-Raymond suffered from back pain for years. She tried every kind of treatment she could think of, everything from chiropractic to physical therapy, acupuncture. She even underwent surgery. She got MRIs. She was prescribed opioids. And after all the time and money that she spent, when nothing really seemed to help, Raymond realized that this was an industry that was worth investigating. That investigation led to her new book, Crooked, Outwitting the Back Pain Industry and Getting on the Road to Recovery. In it, Raymond writes, quote, "Back pain treatment was a microcosm of everything that was wrong with the entire healthcare system. Back trouble in all its permutations costs the U.S. roughly $100 billion a year, and that's more than is spent annually to treat cancer, coronary artery disease, and AIDS combined." She also points out that pain management with pharmaceuticals is linked to the current rate of opioid addiction in the U.S. Her conclusion is that to deal with back pain effectively, you're going to have to rethink your relationship to your pain and also to your lifestyle habits, things like posture and exercise. She also believes there are some very good and effective practitioners out there who really can help people in this process. So, want to talk to a fellow sufferer? There are so many out there, and you're not alone. Catherine Jacobson-Raymond lets us know that, and she's in studio today to talk about all of this. Welcome, Catherine.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
I think there are probably a lot of folks listening saying, oh, you mean it's not just me? They've probably been on their own search, their own hunt for relief for years. So what is it about back pain that makes so many people say, oh, yeah, been there, done that? It's not like neck or shoulder or hip pain. What is it about back pain?
Well, back pain is largely part of the human condition. Very few people will make it off this mortal coil without it. But what has happened in the past several decades is that it has been strongly medicalized. Instead of being basically part of life, something that most people deal with, the statistics suggest that about 80% of Americans will have back pain episodes in their lifetimes, and about over 30% will have them each year. People believe that really they've got a serious problem and that it's structural, that there's been some damage to the spine and that it's dangerous and that it needs treatment. And that's an idea that has been largely perpetrated by the back pain industry, as I describe it in my book, Crooked.
In effect, what you found was a scandal as you first started looking for relief for yourself. So what caused your initial back pain? Was it an incident or did it immediately go straight to severe and chronic?
No. I fell off a horse when I was 16 onto my hip, and I really never rehabilitated that injury. So I began to use muscles that were not really appropriate, and I continued to do that for years. And when I was pregnant with my first son, I had a major attack of sciatica, and then things kind of got worse from there. But it was a slow, incremental build for me. This was never one of those situations where you suddenly stand up and feel as if you've been shot in the hip or the leg. Many people have described that problem. That is, in fact, a better problem to have because generally the pain that comes from one of those sudden attacks will relent. The natural history of back pain is that for most people, within 2 or 3 weeks, the episode is over. It's gone. Some people move to chronicity. It's not clear.
What's that mean?
Well, chronicity is, of course, chronic back pain, and it's not entirely clear why that happens, but the most important new science strongly suggests that we need to look at something called central sensitization, which means that the back pain is no longer being generated in the periphery, you know, not in your back. It's actually being generated in your brain. And that's something that most people never think about. They are committed to the notion that it's structural. Once again, that notion has been perpetrated by the medical community largely because, you know, there's not much you can do. You can't really charge up a bill very well for a brain problem, but you certainly can if you can perform surgery or do MRIs or give epidural steroid injections. Well, if the problem is really in the brain, you know, that really limits the financial upside.
So, but what you're not saying is that this pain is all in your head.
Oh,
or are you?
No. All in your head. What does that mean? Well, one of my chapters is called Head Case. And in no way am I suggesting that it's a quote-unquote psychological problem. There is no such thing, frankly. I mean, science has shown now there's no such thing as a psychological problem. We cannot somehow separate the psyche from the rest of the body. If anyone knows how to do that, please let me know. The brain and all of its cognitive function are obviously inherently tied to every other system and every other aspect of our physiology. So we can't separate that. Are there emotional aspects to back pain? Yes, there definitely are. A lot of people carry their anxiety and their stress and their anger, and they carry it around in their backs. Other people get migraines. Other people have stomach problems. There are all sorts of physical manifestations of anxiety and anger. There's so many of those, but there are a lot of people, and I would include myself in that group, who really carry any kind of anxiety around as a low back problem.
Well, certainly you have a lot of credibility on the issue because you've literally walked this walk. So, as a sufferer, what kinds of remedies did you initially start out seeking, and what kind of outcomes did you get?
Well, just like everybody else, I went through the general first step of, I think the first thing I did was probably see a chiropractor, and that was many, many years ago, as I said, right after my first child was born. And I got caught up in the go there twice a week situation. My insurance was paying for it at that time. You know how long ago that was. And I also went through every other possible intervention. I had physical therapy. I tried multiple kinds of exercise. I never did have epidural steroid injections because I took one look at those very, 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 very long needles.
They're
and
huge.
Said, not for me. I'd already had a couple of epidural injections when my children were born. I wasn't having any more of those. And although you mentioned that I took opioids, that's not actually accurate. There was only one very brief 2-week period when opioids were prescribed for me, and that was shortly after I had a minimally invasive spine surgery, which I hoped would correct the pain and which did not in any kind of long-term way correct the pain. After that surgery, I was prescribed those drugs, and after 2 weeks, I stopped taking them, which was lucky for me because in the course of doing this book, I ran into many, many people who were prescribed opioids. Maybe they started with Vicodin, moved on to extended-release drugs like oxycodone, and were not able to walk away from them. Fortunately for me, I was not very happy on those drugs. They did nothing for me except for make me kind of nauseous and constipated, which is certainly not a desirable outcome, and I stopped taking them.
Well, we all know that there's an opioid crisis that's going on in the country, and we're wondering what extent to which people who are seeking relief from back pain are part of those numbers. About 80 million people a year are diagnosed with back pain, and so many of them are probably seeking relief through opioids, right?
Well, this has become much more difficult, but over the past 2 decades, since the 80s, it's a long story and a story. I must encourage you to buy Crooked and read the chapter called The Opioid Wars. Tonight at the Commonwealth Club, I'll be talking about that chapter and reading from it, in fact. But for 2 decades, there was an inclination to prescribe opioids for any patient who came in And talked about pain. And you may recall if you went to your primary care doctor any time between about 1990 and 2010, you would be asked the question, do you suffer from any pain? And if you said, yes, my back is really killing me, you were very likely to walk away with a prescription for opioids. And you may wonder why that was. Well, it's a very long story, longer than I can get into here. But the pharmaceutical companies, Purdue Pharma in particular, made a gigantic push to make opioids part of the pharmaceutical stable of primary care doctors. And the encouragement was considerable. There were financial considerations as well. And doctors prescribed and prescribed and prescribed. And not until I was well into the research for this book, around 2011, did people, and when I say people, I mean public health experts, really open their eyes and say, holy smokes, what have we done? This is not a street corner addiction problem. This is a physician-driven addiction problem, and it's extremely serious. And that has been made very, very obvious over the last 5 or 6 years.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to investigative journalist Catherine Jacobson Raymond. She suffered back pain for years, and it sent her not only on a search for relief, but she turned up some really startling information about how people are seeking relief for back pain and how the industry is treating them. If you have experience with back pain, what treatments have you found? What worked? What didn't? Do you have questions for Catherine Raymond about her research into the back pain industry? And if you're a healthcare provider and you see patients with back pain, what questions do you have? What insights can you offer on the topic? Give us a call, 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. You can drop us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org, or you can post a web comment at yourcallradio.org. So, Catherine, what is it that struck you most in your research that really surprised or shocked you?
Well, I guess that so many interventions were being ordered for which there was no evidence base. And when I say that, I mean no scientific evidence base.
Such as
tens of thousands of epidural steroid injections were being administered to patients, usually in a series of three. There was no good evidence for those injections, either in sort of standard, ordinary, what we call axial or mechanical low back pain, nor was there any good indication when there was spinal stenosis. And yet, doctors ordered them, and patients submitted to them, and often Medicare paid for them, which means that you and I paid for them effectively. We're in a period here where the cost of healthcare is so high and so controversial, and we are looking at cutting programs that serve the people who absolutely need them. And meanwhile, we are spending hundreds of millions, even billions of dollars on interventions that absolutely do not have an evidence base. This went on, we went much further with this. I began to look at lumbar spinal fusion. A lot of you listeners will be familiar with it. Many of you will have had it. Some of you will have had good outcomes. Many of you will not have had good outcomes, because a very large percentage of people who undergo spinal fusion surgery, lumbar spinal fusion surgery, don't have good outcomes. About 30% are worse off afterwards than they are before. About 40% are about the same. So I wondered, how in the world did this happen? And in a chapter in my book called Gold Standard, I look very closely at what was the evolution of this notion that when a person is in pain, the problem is, in fact, with the vertebrae, and that the solution would be to anchor two vertebrae together so that the joint was no longer functional and that that would somehow solve the problem. Sometimes it does, but rarely. And what happens more often is that a condition called adjacent segment deterioration sets in because you have now got two vertebrae anchored together. They can't move. Other joints begin to suffer and wear out, and eventually another surgery is called for. Well, the problem is that additional surgeries are very, very rarely successful. So I constantly meet people who tell me or hear from people who tell me they've had two or three or four and they're considering another one. And that's a travesty because they're not going to be better. And anyone who's gone through this knows that the recovery from spinal fusion surgery is absolutely brutal. It's a very painful, very invasive procedure, and you don't come out of it quickly. There's a six-month period at least where you really need to be in rehab and you are not yourself. And some people are never themselves. Many studies now have shown that people who undergo lumbar spinal fusion surgery frequently are on the same amount of painkillers that they were on before the surgery and sometimes more. And other studies have shown that people who don't undergo the procedure are in better shape a couple of years later than people who do.
And yet it's still being approved. Does that imply a racket, or what is the implication?
It's still being approved, but it's getting much more difficult for surgeons to get it approved. So for a very long time, one of the indications for this was degenerative disc disease. And in fact, when I was doing my own personal exploration, I received a radiologist's note, and it certainly indicated that I had degenerative disc disease, which of course sounded terrible. And what's happening is that is no longer an indication for lumbar spinal fusion because it's been revealed that degenerative disc disease is, in fact, a marketing term. Everybody over the age of 40 has disc degeneration. It's like having gray hair or having your eyesight change so that you have to hold a book or the newspaper or a menu like arm's length away, or maybe get someone on the other side of the table to hold it for you so that you can read it. It is not, in fact, a disease. There is no such thing. I've heard so many people tell me, A, that they have that, or they have a slip disc. There's also no such thing as a slip disc. I stood in the OR on three different occasions and watched spine surgeries and watched surgeons remove the disc from between the vertebral bones. And believe me, getting that sucker out is a whole lot of work. They do not slip like a hamburger out of a hamburger bun. People have very strange ideas about what's wrong with them, but they almost always are focused on some kind of skeletal anomaly that requires medical correction. And they very rarely think about the muscles and the ligaments that are involved. And these muscles and ligaments go well beyond what are in your lower back. What people frequently fail to realize is that if you have a spine, and that spine has been detached from all its muscles and from all its ligaments, that spine is going to be sitting in a pile in the corner. It will not hold itself up. It is completely dependent on your muscles and your ligaments in your glutes, your thighs, your low back, your core, your upper back, your chest. All of those muscles need to be operating properly and in a balanced fashion. And what goes wrong for so many people is that either the muscles and ligaments become deconditioned or they are imbalanced.
What I'm still hearing is an implication that there is a racket here, that doctors treat, pharmaceutical companies medicate, and people get paid as part of this process that you're saying sounds a bit still experimental, even this far down the road.
It's not really experimental. It's past useful, I think, is a better term.
So they're still doing things that they know don't work?
Well, it's really, I don't like to blame physicians for this. I certainly don't like to blame primary care physicians for this, because primary care physicians are really the dumping ground for the carnage that comes out of the OR. When the spine surgeon is finished and has conducted an X-ray, has ordered an X-ray, and says, look at that, the spinal fusion is perfect. Your vertebral bones have fused. Everything looks ideal. Go forth and be comfortable. And the patient is not comfortable. And that patient ends up back in the care of the primary care doctor for the rest of his or her life. So, you know, is there collusion? Yes, there's collusion. There's collusion between the device manufacturer, and when I say device, I'm referring to spinal instrumentation that is used in spinal fusion surgery, between the device manufacturer and a relatively small group of spine surgeons who serve as consultants to those companies and take down some pretty big checks, and often are responsible for the authorship of papers in scientific or medical journals. And I talk about this extensively in Crooked. It gets way too detailed to go through here, but you know, it's fascinating how this evolved. Yes, I think there is definitely collusion. I think that the DOJ is looking very closely at it, possibly more closely now that this book has come out. You know, if you train as a spine surgeon, you have been in school for like 14 years by the time you're finished. That has been your whole life. It's what you do. You believe that you do a good job. You believe you do the best you can. And that you believe that you're helping people. And it must be just heartbreaking to hear from people that you haven't helped them. It must be something that's almost intolerable for someone who has worked so long to perfect a craft. But I talked to quite a few spine surgeons, and they're well represented in the book, who have acknowledged that what they do is not working.
And yet we've come so far in other kinds of surgery. Just in the last 5 years, the surgery around hip surgery, where they now use titanium and ceramics because they figured the metal on metal, they figured that out. That's not a good idea. That procedure has come so far. Knee surgery has come so far.
Right.
So what is it about the back that seems to elude surgeons when it comes to actually being able to address the problems and the pain associated with back?
That's a really good question, because now let's think a bit about a knee. A knee is a simple hinge, right? Forward, back. It should not be going to the left or the right, and at no time should your foot be at a right angle to your knee facing upward, right? You got a serious problem. So that's a very simple hinge. The hips are more complicated, but still it's a ball and joint, sort of, it's ball in a socket situation. There's not that much latitude in what a hip needs to do. A spine is very, very different. Think about every time you turn around to back the car up, assuming you have an older model car. I mean, I have, you know, one of those mirror systems that I can see on a monitor. I still turn around to back the car up. I don't trust that thing worth a damn. You know? So you have to turn your entire body around. And so that's a much more complicated system. The spine is supported by ligaments that serve as sort of guy wires. It's almost like what holds a tent up. And so when you start detaching those ligaments, which you have to do in order to do a spinal fusion surgery, and actually they're frequently detached for simpler surgeries than that, the kind of decompression surgeries that we think are so, you know, easy and insignificant, there's a lot of damage to muscles and ligaments. And when you start detaching those guy wires, that spine has a tendency to become really unstable. And so that's a problem. Now, surgeons have been looking so hard for solutions, and for a while they thought that artificial disc replacements would work. They profoundly did not work, and I guess we can talk about that a little bit later.
Yes, if you are a back sufferer, back pain sufferer, if you treat people with back pain, Catherine Jacobson-Raymond is the person to talk to. Not only has she been a sufferer, but she is an investigative journalist par excellence. I mean, she has researched this and has insights like I've never heard before. It's a fascinating discussion. Certainly back pain is kind of in the news with Steve Kerr and Tiger Woods. So we're going to talk a bit more about some high-profile sufferers, what Catherine has found works, and we're going to take your calls right after a break. Stay with us.
This is Your Call on KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's toll-free, 866-798-8255. And you can post a comment or question at yourcallradio.org or tweet us at Your Call Radio.
Welcome back. For those of you just joining us, I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in today for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. We're podcasting the show. You can find out more information at yourcallradio.org. Coming up tomorrow, we're asking, what's the right way to do free speech on college campuses? Safe spaces? How do you accommodate hate speech? What about public safety? Free speech zones, the First Amendment, highly politicized, sometimes volatile disagreements have broken out. How do you write a campus free speech code that keeps the vibrancy and the diversity of a college intact, but also protects faculty and students from violence and hate? Then on Thursday, we'll have a conversation around regulation of the digital ride-hailing apps like Lyft and Uber. Today, we're talking with Catherine Jacobson-Raymond. She's the author of the book Crooked, Outwitting the Back Pain Industry and Getting on the Road to Recovery. Raymond is a veteran journalist whose own struggles with back pain have led her to investigate the industry and what is real and what is snake oil out there. So if you've experienced back pain, what treatments have worked and which ones didn't? And if you're a healthcare provider, what questions or insights might you have on the subject? 866-798-8255 is the number. And not surprisingly, Catherine, the phones are lit up. This is one of those subjects everybody has been here or will be at some point. So let's start with Ed in Berkeley. Hi, Ed.
Hi. Glad to talk to you. I had severe back pain. I had a protruded disc. I saw the pictures from the
MRI.
MRI, thank you. Mm-hmm. I'm 75, so I've got a little bit of memory problem. But I had really sixes and sevens up there in the pain scale, and they proffered me
opioids.
Not cortisol, but
an epidural steroid injection.
Yeah, they offered me that too, but they offered me
corticosteroids. Corticosteroids.
No, they gave me a topical corticosteroid, but they offered me codeine. That was it, and I was on. I tried codeine for like a week, and it was just terrible. And I was grouchy and constipated, as you said.
So, what's your question, Ed? What's your question?
Okay, so what happened was they had acupuncture too, and every time I had acupuncture, I would be better, not only feel better, but I was better. But they only could do it every 2 weeks because they only had two two rooms in their building. And so I called the vice president, and I said, you should get more than two rooms because you have this epidemic of
opioids.
Okay,
so I think Ed had a lot folded in there. Opioids, cortical steroids, topicals. So obviously he's one of those people who went on a search and landed on several things that did or did not work.
Well, it sounded as if he had a certain amount of success with acupuncture. Mm. Acupuncture can be really helpful. There is no question about it. But it's not helpful unless you begin to correct the underlying problem. And the underlying problem is nearly always deconditioned muscles and ligaments. I heard something great the other day, Renee. A sore back is a back that needs exercise. And that is not universally true. There are people who have back pain because they've been in car accidents, and there are people who have back pain because they have cancer, and there are people who have infections. But in general, largely, a sore back is a back that needs exercise.
Isn't that counterintuitive? If my back hurts, I don't want to move it. So how do you get over the mental, because you've already made the mind-body connection argument. The body says, pain says, stop what you're doing. Why keep moving it? Your research.
Because what has been learned over and over again is that in the case of low back pain, ordinary low back pain, hurt does not mean harm. And we have been convinced otherwise. We have been convinced because, it's a fairly natural response to pain. If you put you accidentally burn your hand on the oven, you don't go do that again, right? We know that that means don't do that again. It's simply not true with back pain. And so it's a great big hurdle for people. Even yesterday, my son got married this weekend, which was unbelievably exciting. And thank you. Mm-hmm. I was on my feet for, incredible number of hours. And yesterday, I kind of felt lousy. My back was bothering me. And instead of crawling into bed, I got some exercise. And I was amazed because within 10 minutes, it was a thing of the past. My back was no longer bothering me at all. Now, for Ed in Berkeley, it sounds as if, first of all, Ed, as he acknowledged, he has some memory problems, so it's a little hard to know exactly what happened. But he's 75 years old. Protruding discs are basically not a thing at the age of 75, so I don't know who diagnosed that. More likely, Ed was suffering from some stenosis, and he probably still is, and acupuncture can in some ways reduce the inflammation and raise the level of endorphins, and it can make you feel better, but it will never solve your problem.
Actually, Ed called us back. He wanted to say that what actually worked for him was exercise and dancing. So,
oh, good,
there
Ed.
You have it.
Yay, Ed. Oh, thanks for backing me up, Ed. That's great.
Let's go to Vivian. Hi, Vivian.
Hi there. I'm calling because I had some really good luck getting referred to Feldenkrais. And I should probably spell that Feldenkrais. So my understanding is that it works on the nervous system. It kind of reprograms the signals that your nerves send to your brain, like the pain signals. And it works wonders on my back pain, and it actually reorganized the way I stand, the way I hold myself. And I was wondering if you could talk about Feldenkrais and maybe comment on craniosacral therapy as well.
Yes, sure. In my book, In Crooked, I have a fairly long section about Feldenkrais. And here in San Francisco, we have an excellent Feldenkrais Center. I think it's the Feldenkrais Center for Movement and Awareness, I believe is the full name of it. And it's run by some really, really great people. I recommend you look them up. Basically, Feldenkrais, you pretty much have it right, Vivian. It is a matter of reprogramming how you move, how groups of muscles function. It's meant to give you some new options because we get very involved in ingrained motor patterns. If you right now take a look at how you're sitting, assuming you are sitting, and you will find that you are in a kind of weird position. I mean, for instance, right now, I have my left leg crossed over my right knee for no good reason. Mm. I am clutching my hands also for no good reason. I am leaning slightly to the right also for no good reason. But that is a motor pattern that I assume when I am trying to really concentrate, which is what I'm doing now. So Feldenkrais is meant to help your brain come up with some new ways of moving. And I have found that it's very successful, especially for people who are very deconditioned, who really cannot assume any kind of extensive, intensive rehab program right away because they haven't moved in a long time. Older people, even people who are in wheelchairs, successfully enter Feldenkrais programs and do really well. I have a friend who, in his mid-70s, had quite the back pain episode, and he called me and said, I'm seeing two surgeons, I've had an MRI, I have severe stenosis. By the way, everyone always has severe stenosis. Actually, everybody over the age of 50 or so has some stenosis in the spine. It's perfectly standard, normal, often not the cause of trouble. And for my friend, he was convinced that he needed surgery, and he was signed up for it. And I got him off to Feldenkrais program, and he, within a few weeks, surgery, that idea was a thing of the past. He was doing much better. He was doing very well. And most recently, he wrote to me that he was playing tennis again, and he'd been playing with his son and unfortunately had gone for a shot and smacked into a wall and injured his arm, but his back was perfectly fine.
Wow. We love to hear the success stories.
Now, in terms of craniosacral therapy, which was Vivian's other question, I really do not address that in this book. In some ways, Feldenkrais and the Alexander technique share some aspects of craniosacral therapy. My feeling is that at no time will any hands-on therapy that does not involve the extensive participation of the individual, of the patient, in no time will that be successful. The patient has to be engaged in some sort of exercise program in order to recover from this affliction.
You mentioned the Alexander technique, and we have two emails from people who speak very highly of it. The first one says, hello, Joe Gray here. Two studies were done in the UK. The results were published in the British Medical Journal. Patients suffering from back pain that had Alexander technique lessons stayed free of pain the longest, and it was also the most cost-effective way of recovery. And we also heard from someone who has a firsthand experience. My name is Anne, and I had suffered from back and neck pain from an injury for many years. It happened when I was 47. I was first treated with pain meds and physical therapy, but very limited improvement managing the pain. My life during those 6 years was a never-ending cycle of PT, various treatments. Life didn't seem worthwhile living. No sign of hope that I could ever resume a life that was worth living until I stumbled upon the Alexander technique, AT, 10 years ago. Slowly but surely, changes for the better began to take place. I ended up becoming an AT teacher myself. Now at 63, I'm fully engaged in life. Life is fun. What is the Alexander technique?
Okay. Well, I do write extensively about the Alexander technique in Crooked, and I hope that you will find a way to buy the book and read the book and specifically take a look at that section. The Alexander technique, yeah, that is correct. There were two studies in the UK, both published in British Medical Journal, BMJ, showing very good outcomes. They were extremely controversial. Physicians in the UK were not necessarily happy about these outcomes, and certainly doctors who give injections were not. But the Alexander technique technique is a way of reordering your skeleton and creating a certain amount of lightness and float and elegance in the way you move. And I did a number of lessons, and I agree that it is very, very helpful. It is probably not a single solution, in that I still think that most people need to recondition and rehabilitate their back muscles and other associated musculature. But Alexander technique is definitely something that has strong benefits for patients with back pain.
I think people are going to be Googling Alexander technique.
Well, first Google crooked, outwitting the back pain industry and getting on the road to recovery.
Let's go to a practitioner, Kobe in Berkeley. You're a retired neuroradiologist. What are your thoughts?
I just wanted to say that I agree with everything that you've said that I know about, and I'm fine everything else. I know there's a lot of unnecessary.
Sorry, you're breaking up a bit. I'm sorry, so your question is?
Right, I just wanted to tweak one thing that you said. You used the colloquial term slipped disc and cast doubt upon it figuratively. But it's used figuratively, and there are focal disc herniations, extrusions, sequestrations. I won't bother to define the differences, but you know, they pooch out focally, and they can press upon a nerve, cause that nerve to swell. And if the distribution of that nerve is where the signs and symptoms are localized, according to the neurologist or neurosurgeon, there's a chance that fixing that could ameliorate the patient's symptoms. I didn't want everyone to have the misimpression that any sort of quote-unquote slipped disc is fake news.
Thanks, Kobe. All right, Catherine?
Kobe, thank you. Well, my intention there was to suggest that people seem to believe that the disc can slip out and go someplace else entirely. Yes, of course, there are protrusions and extrusions, and sometimes what that means is that the nucleus pulposus, which is the interior of the disc, has effectively busted out through the annulus fibrosus, which is the tough outer ring of the disc. And yes, indeed, it can press on a nerve. And what we do know, though, is that the natural history of that is that over a period of several weeks to sometimes several months, the material that's been extruded does effectively dry up and disappear. So when a patient has what is known as, you know, a herniated disc or protruding disc.
And we've all heard those terms.
We've all heard that. Mm-hmm. And that is used as an indication for surgery. You really need to think twice, because multiple studies show that the outcomes over a two-year period are the same. And everyone goes, well, why the hell would I wait for 2 years? You know, I mean, this can hurt. You know, when this disc material runs into a nerve, it definitely hurts. As he said, as Kobe said, the nerve inflames. It's painful. And why would you wait 2 years? Okay, because when you have surgery, you need to do substantial amount of rehab. If you don't have surgery, you ought to also do that rehab. But surgery plus rehab actually takes quite a while. You may not get back to your full function for some time. And when we know that the disc material dries up and falls off and the pain goes away, it may be worth, definitely for many people, it's worth the wait. People
Anybody.
Panic, though, because yeah. It's extremely painful. My brother went through this just a couple of months ago, and he called me. He said, I just got off a plane from Hawaii, and, you know, it's back in New York. He's can't walk. He's miserable. He's so, so unhappy, and got to go get an MRI and got to see a surgeon. I'm like, do not. Just wait. And 3 weeks later, he was substantially better, and now he's. I just was with him this weekend, playing tennis all weekend, doing just fine.
Anybody who's turned on the television for more than 10 minutes at a time has seen back pain commercials, whether it's Quell, I think it's called, where they do the impulses. You put this thing on your calf, and it sends impulses to the lower back. There's the quick in-and-out surgery with a little Band-Aid at the lower back. There's just all kinds of devices and gizmos, but surgery is actually becoming much more common. And yet, Steve Kerr, we aren't meant to diagnose what his particular problem was, but I believe he said, if you're thinking about back surgery, don't do it.
Yes, he did.
Look at what happened with Tiger Woods. He's not been the same, and pain meds seem to be an issue. So talk about some of the devices and procedures that are being offered out there.
Well, I did notice recently, I was in a Rite Aid, and I saw a giant end of shelf display, you know, Florida, maybe 6 feet high, with a sign that said, you know, hundreds of millions of people are suffering from backache, and there was Tylenol, there was Advil, there was Aleve. Aleve had a new product that was one of these TENS, transcutaneous electrical stimulation devices, which you kind of strap on and it sends these electrical pulses through your skin. And there's no evidence for that either. But there it was, available for anyone to pick up off the shelf. And, you know, what we've seen is that in fact, there's very little use for acetaminophen in treating back pain. It does not seem to be helpful, and there are some risks involved with NSAIDs such as Aleve, Naprosyn,
non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs.
Correct.
NSAIDs, yeah.
Correct. There are risks involved with that in terms of cardiac problems, also gastrointestinal problems. So none of these things seem to be terribly successful.
Also liver, right?
And liver, yes, certainly for acetaminophen, liver. Mm-hmm. And that is very disturbing because, you know, people take tons and tons of this stuff. And, you know, if you go to the end cap in the Rite Aid, there it is, just, you know, advertising itself to you. One of the more upsetting things I ever saw was on a bus shelter, a giant ad, this was in New York City, showed a woman in very high heels looking terribly pained, and the ad said, "Don't worry, Tylenol is here for you." And I thought,
how about we just take off the heels, right?
Yeah, how about we take off those shoes instead? And then I saw another one of a whole bunch of women carrying their babies on their chests, and it was a similar thing, like, "Don't worry, Tylenol will fix your neck and back pain." But your question was, you know, what are the other things that are being offered surgically in terms of those types of interventions? Well, yes, we've all seen the Band-Aid on the back ad. That's just an enormous amount of marketing going into that. I write about it extensively in Crooked. I actually, before I began this book, it was one of the things that really sent me in this direction. I actually did have a surgery like that, a procedure like that. I spoke with many other people who also had those procedures, and the outcomes were generally not great. There are some people who walk away and they're happy, but how long it lasts, that's a question. How much of the positive outcome is because they are taking opioids or they are awash in steroids that have been injected in the course of the surgery? It's not your best bet. It really isn't.
Well, let's try. You know what? It's a good time to take a call from Lilia. She's 79, and she's actually scheduled for surgery pretty soon. Hi, Lilia. Are you there?
Yes. Hi. Just a second. I have to turn on the radio.
Okay. Apparently, she's scheduled for surgery and has a really very well-timed question for you, Catherine.
Yeah. I'm scheduled for surgery. I have severe scoliosis, and I look like hunchbacked. I'm sorry, my English. And no one recommended me a corset or something. Physical therapy did not help. And because I live by myself and because I have no one to take care of me after the surgery, and the rehabilitation will be not 6 months. Medical and Medicare will not pay for 6 months. So can you recommend me, please, a consultation with someone who can recommend me the physical therapy many, many times? It doesn't help.
Okay, so there are good practitioners out there. You've said, Catherine, there are people who can help, yes?
Okay, Lilia, so, you know, I'm an investigative reporter. I am not a physician or any kind of therapist, and therefore, you know, I don't comment on people's specific medical conditions. But you need to take into consideration here that you're 79 years old and you live alone. I assume, is this congenital scoliosis? You were born with this kind of curve? Is that correct? Or did this come on later in life?
I'm not sure Lilia's still there, but...
Okay. Sorry, Lilia. You have to consider the potential that you will not recover from this surgery. It's very, very difficult, and I think that physicians are much too inclined to do this surgery when patients come to them and say, I've tried everything. I've been through physical therapy. Nothing helps. You know, doctor, what am I to do? They are more inclined to recommend surgery because, frankly, they are not going to deal with your outcome. They are going to walk away from your outcome. And I don't know whether you're still listening, but I definitely would recommend that before you do any of this, you spend some time in a Feldenkrais program. Kaiser runs one. You can go to it even if you're not a member of Kaiser. But you are going to have a heck of a recovery, and it's going to potentially land you, you know, in a nursing home facility.
Okay, we have a little less than a minute left, and we still have folks who have so many questions, not surprisingly. And we also have emails that are cautionary tales. One says, my sister died from failed back surgery. It should be a last resort. So maybe that's the takeaway, Catherine. I want to give you an opportunity to do one brief takeaway before we talk about your book events. We've got less than a minute.
It's really not a last resort. It's not a resort, you know, in the true sense of that word. Surgery is not, you know, the only remaining option because the outcomes tend to be so poor. I'm talking primarily here about spinal fusion surgery, particularly in older people who are deconditioned or even younger people who are. So, don't think, you know, only remaining option. Let's look at rehabilitation as the main option, the best option. And my book addresses all of these choices extensively.
And Catherine Jacobson-Raymond's book is called Crooked, Outwitting the Back Pain Industry, Getting on the Road to Recovery. Thank you so much for joining us, Catherine. And for all of the listeners for tuning in, sorry we couldn't get to all of you. Tomorrow, free speech on college campuses. Catherine will be at the Commonwealth Club tonight at 7 o'clock, and you might want to join her there. Today's show is produced by Allie Butner, and we hope that you'll join us tomorrow on Your Call. I'm Renee Kemp.